I died. I didn't. Had finally stopped their squabbling. Back by the board fence that had been, where the two businessmen had been playing tic-tac-toe with a Mark Cross pen. And, of course, there had been the relief of being away from the Piper school and the insanity of his final essay for Miss Avery's English class. The final essay counted a full 25% toward each student's final grade. Miss Avery had made that perfectly clear, and Jake's had been gibberish. The fact that his teacher had later given him an A-plus on it didn't change that, only made it clear that it wasn't just him. The whole world was losing its shit, going 19. Being out from under all that, even for a little while, had been great. Of course he was digging the day. Only the day's not quite right, Jake thought, the Jake walking along behind his old self. Something about it. He looked around, but couldn't figure it out. Late May, bright summer sun, lots of strollers and window shoppers on Second Avenue, plenty of taxis, the occasional long black limo. Nothing wrong with any of this. Except there was. Everything was wrong with it. 3. Eddie felt the kid twitch his sleeve. "What's wrong with this picture?" Jake asked. Eddie looked around. In spite of his own adjustment problems, his involved coming back to a New York that was clearly a few years behind his win, he knew what Jake meant. Something was wrong. He looked down at the sidewalk, suddenly sure he wouldn't have a shadow. They'd lost their shadows like the kids in one of the stories, one of the 19 fairy tales, or was it maybe something newer, like The Lion, The Witch, and The Wardrobe, or Peter Pan, one of what might be called the modern 19? Didn't matter in any case, because their shadows were there. Shouldn't be, though, Eddie thought. Shouldn't be able to see our shadows when it's this dark. Stupid thought. It wasn't dark. It was morning, for Christ's sake. A bright May morning, sunshine winking off the chrome of passing cars and the windows of the stores on the east side of Second Avenue, brightly enough to make you squint your eyes. Yet still it seemed somehow dark to Eddie, as if all this were nothing but fragile surface, like the canvas backdrop of a stage set. At Rise, we see the Forest of Arden, or a castle in Denmark, or the kitchen of Willie Loman's house. In this case, we see Second Avenue, Midtown, New York. Yes, like that, only behind this canvas, you wouldn't find the workshop and storage areas of backstage, but only a great, bulging darkness, some vast, dead universe where Roland's tower had already fallen. Please let me be wrong, Eddie thought. Please let this just be a case of culture shock or the plain old heebie-jeebies. He didn't think it was. How'd we get here? He asked Jake. There was no door. He trailed off and then asked with some hope, maybe it is a dream? No, Jake said. It's more like when we traveled in the wizard's glass, except this time there was no ball. A thought struck him. Did you hear music, though? Chimes? Just before you wound up here? Eddie nodded. It was sort of overwhelming, made my eyes water. Right, Jake said. Exactly. Oi sniffed a fire hydrant. Eddie and Jake paused to let the little guy lift his leg and add his own notice to what was undoubtedly an already crowded bulletin board. Ahead of them, that other Jake, kid 77, was still walking slowly and gawking everywhere. To Eddie, he looked like a tourist from Michigan. He even craned up to see the tops of the buildings, and Eddie had an idea that if the New York Board of Cynicism caught you doing that, they took away your Bloomingdale's charge card. Not that he was complaining. It made the kid easy to follow. And just as Eddie was thinking that, kid 77 disappeared. Where'd you go? Christ, where'd you go? Relax, Jake said. At his ankle, Oi added his 2 cents worth. Axe! The kid was grinning. I just went into the bookstore, the Manhattan Restaurant of the Mind, it's called. Where you got Charlie the Choo-Choo in the riddle book? Right. Eddie loved the mystified, dazzled grin Jake was wearing. It lit up his whole face. Remember how excited Roland got when I told him the owner's name? Eddie did. The owner of the Manhattan Restaurant of the Mind was a fellow named Calvin Tower. Hurry up, Jake said. I want to watch. Eddie didn't have to be asked twice. He wanted a watch, too. 4. Jake stopped in the doorway to the bookstore. His smile didn't fade exactly, but it faltered.
"What is it?" Eddie asked. "What's wrong?"
"Dunno. Something's different, I think. It's just so much has happened since I was here."
He was looking at the chalkboard in the window, which Eddie thought was actually a very clever way of selling books. It looked like the sort of thing you saw in diners, or maybe the fish markets. "Today's specials. From Mississippi, pan-fried William Faulkner, hardcovers, market price, vintage library paperbacks, 75 cents each. From Maine, chilled Stephen King, hardcovers, market price, book club bargains, paperbacks, 75 cents each. From California, hard-boiled Raymond Chandler, hardcovers, market price, paperbacks, 7 for $5. Eddie looked beyond this and saw that other Jake, the one without the tan or the look of hard clarity in his eyes, standing at a small display table. Kiddie books. Probably both the 19 fairy tales and the modern 19. "Quit it," he told himself. "That's obsessive-compulsive crap, and you know it." Maybe, but good old Jake 77 was about to make a purchase from that table, which had gone on to change and very likely to save their lives. He'd worry about the number 19 later, or not at all, if he could manage it. "Come on," he told Jake. "Let's go in." The boy hung back. "What's the matter?" Eddie asked. "Tower won't be able to see us if that's what you're worried about."
"Tower won't be able to," Jake said. "But what if he can?"
He pointed at his other self, the one who had yet to meet Gasher and TikTok and the old people of River Crossing, the one who had yet to meet Blaine the Mono and Rhea of the Coos. Jake was looking at Eddie with a kind of haunted curiosity.
"What if I see myself?"
Eddie supposed that might really happen. Hell, anything might happen. But that didn't change what he felt in his heart. "I think we're supposed to go in, Jake."
"Yeah."
It came out in a long sigh.
"I do too."
5. They went in, and they weren't seen, and Eddie was relieved to count 21 books on the display table that had attracted the boy's notice. Except, of course, when Jake picked up the two he wanted, Charlie the Choo-Choo and the Riddle Book, that left 19.
"Find something, son?"
a mild voice inquired. It was a fat fellow in an open-throated white shirt. Behind him, at a counter that looked as if it might have been filched from a turn-of-the-century soda fountain, a trio of old guys were drinking coffee and nibbling pastries. A chessboard with a game in progress sat on the marble counter.
"The guy sitting on the end is Aaron Deepnow," Jake whispered. "He's going to explain the riddle about Samson to me."
"Shh," Eddie said. He wanted to hear the conversation between Calvin Tower and Kid 77. All of a sudden, that seemed very important. Only why was it so fucking dark in here? Except it's not dark at all. The east side of the street gets plenty of sun at this hour, and with the door open, this place is getting all of it. How can you say it's dark? Because it somehow was. The sunlight, the contrast of the sunlight only made it worse. The fact that you couldn't exactly see that darkness made it worse still. And Eddie realized a terrible thing. These people were in danger. Tower, Deepnow, Kid 77, probably him and Midworld, Jake and Oi as well. All of them. 6. Jake watched his other, younger self take a step back from the bookshop owner, his eyes widening in surprise. "Because his name is Tower," Jake thought. "That's what surprised me. Not because of Roland's Tower, though. I didn't know about that yet. But because of the picture I put on the last page of my final essay." He had pasted a photo of the Leaning Tower of Pisa on the last page, then had scribbled all over it with a black Crayola, darkening it as best he could. Tower asked him his name. 77 Jake told him, and Tower joked around with him a little. It was good joking around, the kind you got from adults who really didn't mind kids.
"Good handle, pard," Tower was saying. "Sounds like the footloose hero in a Western novel, the guy who blows into Black Fork, Arizona, cleans up the town, and then travels on. Something by Wayne D. Overholzer, maybe.
Jake took a step closer to his old self. Part of him was thinking what a wonderful sketch all this would make on Saturday Night Live. And his eyes widened slightly. Eddie! He was still whispering, although he knew the people in the bookstore couldn't. Except, maybe on some level they could. He remembered the lady back on 54th Street twitching her skirt up at the knee so she could step over Oi. And now Calvin Towers' eyes shifted slightly in his direction before going back to the other version of him.
"Might be good not to attract unnecessary attention," Eddie muttered in his ear.
"I know," Jake said, "but look at Charlie the Choo-Choo, Eddie."
Eddie did, and for a moment saw nothing, except for Charlie himself, of course, Charlie with his headlight eye and not-quite-trustworthy cowcatcher grin. Then Eddie's eyebrows went up.
"I thought Charlie the Choo-Choo was written by a lady named Beryl Evans," he whispered.
Jake nodded.
"I did too."
"Then who's this?" Eddie took another look. "Who's this Claudia E. Inez Backman?"
"I have no idea," Jake said. "I never heard of her in my life."
7. One of the old men at the counter came sauntering toward them. Eddie and Jake drew away. As they stepped back, Eddie's spine gave a cold little wrench. Jake was very pale, and Oi was giving out a series of low, distressed whines. Something was wrong here, all right. In a way, they had lost their shadows. Eddie just didn't know how. Kid 77 had taken out his wallet and was paying for the two books. There was some more talk and good-natured laughter, then he headed for the door. When Eddie started after him, mid-whirl, Jake grabbed his arm.
"No, not yet. I come back in."
"I don't care if you alphabetize the whole place," Eddie said. "Let's wait out on the sidewalk."
Jake thought about this, biting his lip, then nodded. They headed for the door, then stopped, and moved aside as the other Jake returned. The riddle book was open. Calvin Tower had lumbered over to the chessboard on the counter. He looked around with an amiable smile.
"Change your mind about that cup of coffee, O Hyperborean wanderer?"
"No, I wanted to ask you—"
"This is the part about Samson's riddle," Midworld Jake said. "I don't think it matters, although the Deepno guy sings a pretty good song if you want to hear it."
"I'll pass," Eddie said. "Come on."
They went out. And although things on Second Avenue were still wrong, that sense of endless dark behind the scenes, behind the very sky, it was somehow better than in the Manhattan Restaurant of the Mind. At least, there was fresh air.
"Tell you what," Jake said, "let's go down to 2nd and 46th right now."
He jerked his head toward the version of him listening to Aaron Deepno sing,
"I'll catch up with us."
Eddie considered it, then shook his head. Jake's face fell a little.
"Don't you want to see the rose?"
"You bet your ass I do," Eddie said. "I'm wild to see it."
"Then?"
"I don't feel like we're done here yet. I don't know why, but I don't."
Jake, the Kid 77 version of him, had left the door open when he went back inside, and now Eddie moved into it. Aaron Deepno was telling Jake a riddle they would later try on Blaine the Mono. "What can run but never walks, has a mouth but never talks?" Midworld Jake, meanwhile, was once more looking at the notice board in the bookstore window. Pan-fried William Faulkner, hard-boiled Raymond Chandler. He wore a frown of the kind that expresses doubt and anxiety rather than ill temper.
"That sign's different, too," he said.
"How?"
"I can't remember."
"Is it important?"
Jake turned to him. The eyes below the furrowed brow were haunted.
"I don't know. It's another riddle. I hate riddles."
Eddie sympathized. "When is a Beryl not a Beryl?"
"When it's a Claudia," he said.
"Huh?
Never mind. Better step back, Jake, or you're going to run into yourself."
Jake gave the oncoming version of John Chambers a startled glance, then did as Eddie suggested. And when Kid 77 started on down 2nd Avenue with his new books in his left hand, mid-whirl, Jake gave Eddie a tired smile.
"I do remember one thing," he said. "When I left this bookstore, I was sure I'd never come here again. But I did."
"Considering that we're more ghosts than people, I'd say that's debatable."
Eddie gave the back of Jake's neck a friendly scruff. And if you have forgotten something important, Roland might be able to help you remember. He's good at that.
Jake grinned at this, relieved. He knew from personal experience that the gunslinger really was good at helping people remember. Roland's friend Alan might have been the one with the strongest ability to touch other minds, and his friend Cuthbert had gotten all the sense of humor in that particular quartet, but Roland had developed over the years into one hell of a hypnotist. He could have made a fortune in Las Vegas.
"Can we follow me now?" Jake asked. "Check out the rose?"
He looked up and down Second Avenue, a street that was somehow bright and dark at the same time, with a kind of unhappy perplexity. "Things are probably better there. The rose makes everything better." Eddie was about to say okay when a dark, gray Lincoln Town car pulled up in front of Calvin Towers' bookshop. It parked by the yellow curb in front of a fire hydrant with absolutely no hesitation. The front doors opened, and when Eddie saw who was getting out from behind the wheel, he seized Jake's shoulder.
"Ow!" Jake said. "Man, that hurts!"
Eddie paid no attention. In fact, the hand on Jake's shoulder clamped down even tighter.
"Christ!" Eddie whispered. "Dear Jesus Christ, what's this? What in hell is this?"
8. Jake watched Eddie go past pale to ashy gray. His eyes were bulging from their sockets. Not without difficulty, Jake pried the clamping hand off his shoulder. Eddie made as if to point with that hand, but didn't seem to have the strength. It fell against the side of his leg with a little thump. The man who had gotten out on the passenger side of the town car walked around to the sidewalk while the driver opened the rear curbside door. Even to Jake, their moves looked practiced, almost like steps in a dance. The man who got out of the back seat was wearing an expensive suit, but that didn't change the fact that he was basically a dumpy little guy with a pot belly and black hair going gray around the edges. Dandruffy black hair from the look of his suit's shoulders. To Jake, the day suddenly felt darker than ever. He looked up to see if the sun had gone behind a cloud. It hadn't, but it almost seemed to him that there was a black corona forming around its brilliant circle, like a ring of mascara around a startled eye. Half a block farther downtown, the 1977 version of him was glancing in the window of a restaurant, and Jake could remember the name of it, Choo Choo Mama's. Not far beyond it was Tower of Power Records, where he would think towers are selling cheap today. If that version of him had looked back, he would have seen the gray town car. But he hadn't. Kid 77's mind was fixed firmly on the future.
"It's Balazar," Eddie said.
"What?" Eddie was pointing at the dumpy guy who had paused to adjust his sulca tie. The other two now stood flanking him. They looked simultaneously relaxed and watchful.
"Enrico Balazar, and looking much younger. God, he's almost middle-aged."
"It's 1977, Jake reminded him. Then, as the penny dropped,
"That's the guy you and Roland killed?"
Eddie had told Jake the story of the shootout at Balazar's club in 1987, leaving out the gorier parts. The part, for instance, where Kevin Blake had lobbed the head of Eddie's brother into Balazar's office in an effort to flush Eddie and Roland into the open. Henry Dean, the great sage and eminent junkie.
"Yeah," Eddie said, "the guy Roland and I killed. And the one who was driving, that's Jack Andolini. Old Double Ugly, people used to call him, although never to his face. He went through one of those doors with me just before the shooting started."
"Roland killed him too, didn't he?" Eddie nodded. It was simpler than trying to explain how Jack Andolini had happened to die blind and faceless beneath the tearing claws and ripping jaws of the lobstrosities on the beach.
"The other bodyguard's George Biondi, big nose. I killed him myself. Will kill him 10 years from now."
Eddie looked as if he might faint in any second.
"Eddie, are you okay?" "I guess so. I guess I have to be."
They had drawn away from the bookshop's doorway. Oi was still crouched at Jake's ankle. Down Second Avenue, Jake's other, earlier self had disappeared.
"I'm running by now," Jake thought. "Maybe jumping over the UPS guy's dolly, sprinting all out for the delicatessen, because I'm sure that's the way back to Midworld, the way back to him."
Balazar peered at his reflection in the window beside the Today's Specials display board, gave the wings of hair above his ears one last little fluff with the tips of his fingers, then stepped through the open door. Andolini and Biondi followed.
"Hard guys," Jake said.
"The hardest," Eddie agreed.
"From Brooklyn?"
"Well, yeah.
Why are hard guys from Brooklyn visiting a used bookstore in Manhattan?"
"I think that's what we're here to find out.
Jake, did I hurt your shoulder?"
"I'm okay. But I don't really want to go back in there."
"Neither do I, so let's go."
They went back into the Manhattan restaurant of the mind. 9. Hoy was still at Jake's heel and still whining. Jake wasn't crazy about the sound, but he understood it. The smell of fear in the bookstore was palpable. Deep Nose sat beside the chessboard, gazing unhappily at Calvin Tower and the newcomers, who didn't look much like bibliophiles in search of the elusive signed first edition. The other two old guys at the counter were drinking the last of their coffee in big gulps with the air of fellows who have just remembered important appointments elsewhere. Cowards, Jake thought, with a contempt he didn't recognize as a relatively new thing in his life. Low bellies. Being old forgives some of it, but not all of it.
"We just have a couple of things to discuss, Mr. Torren," Balazar was saying. He spoke in a low, calm, reasonable voice, without even a trace of accent. "Please, if we could step back into your office."
"We don't have business," Tower said.
His eyes kept drifting to Andolini. Jake supposed he knew why. Jack Andolini looked the axe-wielding psycho in a horror movie.
"Come July 15th, we might have business. Might. So we could talk after the 4th, I guess, if you wanted to."
He smiled, to show he was being reasonable.
"But now, gee, I just don't see the point. It's not even June yet, and for your information, my name's not..."
"He doesn't see the point," Balazar said.
He looked at Andolini, looked at the one with the big nose, raised his hands to his shoulders, then dropped them.
"What's wrong with this world of ours?" the gesture said. "Jack, George, this man took a check from me. The amount before the decimal point was a 1 followed by 5 zeros. And now he says he doesn't see the point of talking to me."
"Unbelievable," Biondi said.
Andolini said nothing. He simply looked at Calvin Tower, muddy brown eyes peering out from beneath the unlovely bulge of his skull like mean little animals peering out of a cave. With a face like that, Jake supposed, you didn't have to talk much to get your point across. The point being intimidation.
"I want to talk to you," Balazar said.
He spoke in a patient, reasonable tone of voice, but his eyes were fixed on Tower's face with a terrible intensity.
"Why? Because my employers in this matter want me to talk to you. That's good enough for me. And do you know what? I think you can afford 5 minutes of chit-chat for your 100 grand, don't you?"
"The 100,000 is gone," Tower said bleakly. "As I'm sure you and whoever hired you must know."
"That's of no concern to me," Balazar said. "Why would it be? It was your money. What concerns me is whether or not you're going to take us out back. If not, we'll have to have our conversation right here, in front of the whole world."
The whole world now consisted of Aaron Deepnow, one Billy Bumbler, and a couple of expatriate New Yorkers none of the men in the bookstore could see. Deep Nose counterbuddies had run like the low bellies they were. Tower made one last try.
"I don't have anyone to mind the store. Lunch hour's coming up, and we often have quite a few browsers during..."
"This place doesn't do $50 a day," Andolini said. "And we all know it, Mr. Torren. If you're really worried you're going to miss a big sale, let him run the cash register for a few minutes."
For one horrible second, Jake thought the one Eddie had called Old Double Ugly meant none other than John Jake Chambers. Then he realized Andolini was pointing past him at Deepnow. Tower gave in, or Torren.
"Aaron," he asked, "do you mind?"
"Not if you don't," Deepnow said.
He looked troubled. Sure you want to talk with these guys?
Biondi gave him a look. Jake thought Deepno stood up under it remarkably well. In a weird way, he felt proud of the old guy.
Yeah, Tower said. Yeah, it's fine.
Don't worry, he won't lose his butthole virginity on our account, Biondi said, and laughed. Watch your mouth. You're in a place of scholarship, Balazar said, but Jake thought he smiled a little. Come on, Torin, just a little chat.
That's not my name. I had it legally changed on...
Whatever, Balazar said, soothingly. He actually patted Tower's arm. Jake was still trying to get used to the idea that all this melodrama had happened after he'd left the store with his two new books, new to him anyway, and resumed his journey. That it had all happened behind his back.
A squarehead's always a squarehead, right, boss?
Biondi asked jovially.
Just a Dutchman, don't matter what he calls himself.
Balazar said, If I want you to talk, George, I'll tell you what I want you to say. Have you got that?
Okay,
Biondi said. Then, perhaps after deciding that didn't sound quite enthusiastic enough,
Yeah, sure.
Good. Balazar, now holding the arm he had patted, guided Tower toward the back of the shop. Books were piled helter-skelter here. The air was heavy with the scent of a million musty pages. There was a door marked Employees Only. Tower produced a ring of keys, and they jingled slightly as he picked through them.
His hands are shaking, Jake murmured.
Eddie nodded. Mine would be, too. Tower found the key he wanted, turned it in the lock, opened the door. He took another look at the three men who had come to visit him, hard guys from Brooklyn, then led them into the back room. The door closed behind them, and Jake heard the sound of a bolt being shot across. He doubted Tower himself had done that. Jake looked up into the convex, anti-shoplifting mirror mounted in the corner of the shop, saw Deepno pick up the telephone beside the cash register, consider it, then put it down again.
What do we do now? Jake asked Eddie. I'm going to try something, Eddie said. I saw it in a movie once. He stood in front of the closed door, then tipped Jake a wink. Here I go. If I don't do anything but bump my head, feel free to call me an asshole.
Before Jake could ask him what he was talking about, Eddie walked into the door. Jake saw his eyes close and his mouth tighten in a grimace. It was the expression of a man who expects to take a hard knock, only there was no hard knock. Eddie simply passed through the door. For one moment his moccasin-clad foot was sticking out, and then it went through too. There was a low, rasping sound like a hand being passed over rough wood. Jake bent down and picked Oi up.
Close your eyes, he said.
Eyes,
the bumbler agreed, but continued to look at Jake with that expression of calm adoration. Jake closed his own eyes, squinting them shut. When he opened them again, Oi was mimicking him. Without wasting any time, Jake walked into the door with the Employees Only sign on it. There was a moment of darkness and the smell of wood. Deep in his head, he heard a couple of those disturbing chimes again. Then... he was through. 10. It was a storage area, much bigger than Jake had expected, almost as big as a warehouse, and stacked high with books in every direction. He guessed that some of those stacks, held in place by pairs of upright beams that provided shoring rather than shelving, had to be 14 or 16 feet high. Narrow, crooked aisles ran between them. In a couple, he saw rolling platforms that made him think of the portable boarding ramps you saw in smaller airports. The smell of old books was the same back here as in front, but ever so much stronger, almost overwhelming. Above them hung a scattering of shaded lamps that provided yellowish, uneven illumination. The shadows of Tower, Balazar, and Balazar's friends leaped grotesquely on the wall to their left. Tower turned that way, leading his visitors to a corner that really was an office. There was a desk with a typewriter and a Rolodex on it, three old filing cabinets, and a wall covered with various pieces of paperwork. There was a calendar with some 19th-century guy on the May sheet Jake didn't recognize. And then he did. Robert Browning. Jake had quoted him in his final essay. Tower sat down in the chair behind his desk and immediately seemed sorry he'd done that. Jake could sympathize. The way the other three crowded around him couldn't have been very pleasant. Their shadows jumped up the wall behind the desk like the shadows of gargoyles. Balazar reached into his suit coat and brought out a folded sheet of paper. He opened it and put it down on Tower's desk. "Recognize this?" Eddie moved forward. Jake grabbed at him.
"Don't go close. They'll sense you."
"I don't care," Eddie said. "I need to see that paper." Jake followed, not knowing what else to do. Oi stirred in his arms and whined. Jake shushed him curtly, and Oi blinked.
"Sorry, buddy," Jake said, "but you have to keep quiet."
Was the 1977 version of him in the vacant lot yet? Once inside it, that earlier Jake had slipped somehow and knocked himself unconscious. Had that happened yet? No sense wondering. Eddie was right. Jake didn't like it, but he knew it was true. They were supposed to be here, not there, and they were supposed to see the paper Balazar was now showing Calvin Tower. 11. Eddie got the first couple of lines before Jack Andolini said,
"Boss, I don't like this. Something feels hinky."
Balazar nodded. "I agree. Is someone back here with us, Mr. Torrin?" He still sounded calm and courteous, but his eyes were everywhere, assessing this large room's potential for concealment.
"No," Tower said. "Well, there's Sergio. He's the shop cat. I imagine he's back here somewhere."
"This ain't no shop," Biondi said. "It's a hole you pour money into. One of those she-she designers that have trouble making enough to cover the overhead on a joint this big. And a bookstore? Man, who are you kidding?"
Himself, that's who, Eddie thought. He's been kidding himself. As if this thought had summoned them, those terrible chimes began again. The hoods gathered in Tower's storeroom office didn't hear them, but Jake and Oi did. Eddie could read it on their distressed faces, and suddenly this room, already dim, began to grow dimmer still.
"We're going back," Eddie thought. "Jesus, we're going back. But not before."
He bent forward between Andolini and Balazar, aware that both men were looking around with wide, wary eyes, not caring. What he cared about was the paper. Someone had hired Balazar first to get it signed, probably, and then to shove it under Tower Torin's nose when the time was right, certainly. In most cases, Il Roche would have been content to send a couple of his hard boys, what he called his gentlemen, on an errand like that. This job, however, was important enough to warrant his personal attention. Eddie wanted to know why.
Memorandum of Agreement. This document constitutes a pact of agreement between Mr. Calvin Tower, a New York State resident, owning real property which is principally a vacant lot, identified as lot number 298 and block number 19, located...
Those chimes wriggled through his head again, making him shiver. This time they were louder.
The shadows drew thicker, leaping up the storage room's walls. The darkness Eddie had sensed out on the street was breaking through. They might be swept away, and that would be bad. They might be drowned in it, and that would be worse. Of course it would. Being drowned in darkness would surely be an awful way to go. And suppose there were things in that darkness,
hungry things like the doorkeeper.
There are. That was Henry's voice. For the first time in almost 2 months, Eddie could imagine Henry standing just behind him and grinning a sallow junkie's grin, all bloodshot eyes and yellow, uncared-for teeth.
You know there are. But when you hear the chimes, you gotta go, bro, as I think you know.
Eddie, Jake cried, it's coming back, do you hear it? Grab my belt, Eddie said. His eyes raced back and forth over the paper in Tower's pudgy hands. Balazar, Andolini, and Big Nose were still looking around. Biondi had actually drawn his gun.
Maybe we won't be separated, Eddie said.
The chimes were louder than ever, and he groaned. The words of the agreement blurred in front of him. Eddie squinted his eyes, bringing the print back together.
Identified as lot number 298 and block number 19, located in Manhattan, New York City, on 46th Street and 2nd Avenue, and Sombra Corporation, a corporation doing business within the state of New York. On this day of July 15, 1976, Sombra is paying a non-returnable sum of $100,000 to Calvin Tower, receipt of which is acknowledged in regard to this property. In consideration thereof, Calvin Tower agrees not to...
July 15, 1976, not quite a year ago. Eddie felt the darkness sweeping down on them and tried to cram the rest of it through his eyes and into his brain, enough maybe to make sense of what was going on here. If he could do that, it would be at least a step toward figuring out what all this meant to them. If the chimes don't drive me crazy. If the things in the darkness don't eat us on the way back.
Eddie!
Jake. And terrified by the sound, Eddie ignored him.
Calvin Tower agrees not to sell or lease or otherwise encumber the property during a one-year period commencing on the date hereof and ending on July 15, 1977. It is understood that the Sombra Corporation shall have first right of purchase on the above-mentioned property as defined below. During this period, Calvin Tower will fully preserve and protect Sombra Corporation's stated interest in the above-mentioned property and will permit no liens or other encumbrances.
There was more, but now the chimes were hideous, head-bursting. For just one moment, Eddie understood, hell, could almost see how thin this world had become, all of the worlds, probably, as thin and worn as his own jeans. He caught one final phrase from the agreement. If these conditions are met, we'll have the right to sell or otherwise dispose of the property to Sombra or any other party. Then the words were gone. Everything was gone, spinning into a black whirlpool. Jake held onto Eddie's belt with one hand and Oi with the other. Oi was barking wildly now, and Eddie had another confused image of Dorothy being swirled away to the land of Oz. There were things in the darkness, looming shapes behind weird phosphorescent eyes, the sort of things you saw in movies about exploring the deepest cracks of the ocean floor. Except in those movies, the explorers were always inside a steel diving bell, while he and Jake... The chimes grew to an ear-splitting volume. Eddie felt as if he had been jammed headfirst into the works of Big Ben as it was striking midnight. He screamed without hearing himself, and then... It was gone. Everything was all gone. Jake, Oi, Midworld, and he was floating somewhere beyond the stars and the galaxies.
Susanna, he cried. Where are you, Suze?
No answer. Only darkness. Chapter 3. Mia. 1. Once upon a time, back in the 60s, before the world moved on, there had been a woman named Odetta Holmes, a pleasant and really quite socially conscious young woman who was wealthy, good-looking, and perfectly willing to look out for the other guy, or gal. Without even realizing it, this woman shared her body with a far less pleasant creature named Detta Walker. Detta did not give a tin shit for the other guy, or gal. Rhea of the Coos would have recognized Detta and called her sister.
On the other side of Midworld, Roland of Gilead, the last gunslinger, had drawn this divided woman to him and had created a third who was far better, far stronger than either of the previous two. This was the woman with whom Eddie Dean had fallen in love. She called him husband, and thus herself by the name of his father. Having missed the feminist squabbles of later decades, she did this quite happily. If she did not call herself Susanna Dean with pride as well as happiness, it was only because her mother had taught her that pride goeth before a fall. Now there was a fourth woman. She had been born out of the third in yet another time of stress and change. She cared nothing for Odetta, Detta, or Susanna. She cared for nothing save the new chap who was on his way. The new chap needed to be fed. The banqueting hall was near. That was what mattered, and all that mattered.
This new woman, every bit as dangerous in her own way as Detta Walker had been, was Mia. She bore the name of no man's father. Only the word that in the high speech means mother.
2. She walked slowly down long stone corridors toward the place of feasting. She walked past the rooms of ruin, past the empty naves and niches, past forgotten galleries where the apartments were hollow and none was the number. Somewhere in this castle stood an old throne drenched in ancient blood. Somewhere ladderways led to bone-walled crypts that went gods knew how deep. Yet there was life here, life and rich food. Mia knew this as well as she knew the legs under her and the textured, many-layered skirt swishing against them. Rich food. Life for you and for your crop, as the saying went. And she was so hungry now. Of course. Wasn't she eating for two? She came to a broad staircase. A sound, faint but powerful, rose up to her. The beat, beat, beat of slow-trans engines buried in the earth below the deepest of the crypts. Mia cared nothing for them, nor for North Central Positronics Limited, which had built them and set them in motion tens of thousands of years before. She cared nothing for the dipolar computers, or the doors, or the beams, or the dark tower which stood at the center of everything.
What she cared about was the smells. They drifted up to her, thick and wonderful. Chicken and gravy and roasts of pork dressed in suits of crackling fat. Sides of beef beaded with blood, wheels of moist cheese. Huge calafundi shrimp like plump orange commas. Split fish with staring black eyes, their bellies brimming with sauce. Great pots of jambalaya and fanata, the vast caldo largo stews of the far south. Add to this 100 fruits and 1,000 sweets, and still you were only at the beginning. The appetizers, the first mouthfuls of the first course.
Mia ran quickly down the broad central staircase, the skin of her palm skimming silkily along the banister, her small slippered feet stuttering on the steps. Once she'd had a dream that she had been pushed in front of an underground train by an awful man, and her legs had been cut off at the knee. But dreams were foolish. Her feet were there, and the legs above them, weren't they? Yes. And so was the babe in her belly. The chap, wanting to be fed. He was hungry. And so was she. 3. From the foot of the stairs, a wide corridor floored with polished black marble ran 90 feet to a pair of tall double doors. Mia hurried that way. She saw her reflection floating below her and the electric flambeau that burned in the depths of the marble like torches underwater, but she did not see the man who came along behind her, descending the sweeping curve of the stairs not in dress pumps but in old and range-battered boots. He wore faded jeans and a shirt of blue chambray instead of court clothes. One gun, a pistol with a worn sandalwood grip, hung at his left side, the holster tied down with rawhide. His face was tanned and lined and weathered.
His hair was black, although now seeded with growing streaks of white. His eyes were his most striking feature. They were blue and cold and steady. Detta Walker had feared no man, not even this one. But she had feared those shooter's eyes. There was a foyer just before the double doors. It was floored with red and black marble squares. The wood-paneled walls were hung with faded portraits of old lords and ladies. In the center was a statue made of entwined rose marble and chrome steel. It seemed to be a knight-errant with what might have been a six-gun or a short sword raised above his head. Although the face was mostly smooth, the sculptor had done no more than hint at the features. Mia knew who it was, right enough. Who it must be.
"I salute thee, Arthur Eld," she said, and dropped her deepest curtsy. "Please bless these things I'm about to take to my use, and to the use of my chap. Good evening to you." She could not wish him long days upon the earth, for his days and those of most of his kind were gone. Instead, she touched her smiling lips with the tips of her fingers and blew him a kiss. Having made her manners, she walked into the dining hall.
It was 40 yards wide and 70 yards long, that room. Brilliant electric torches and crystal sheaths lined both sides. Hundreds of chairs stood in place at a vast ironwood table laden with delicacies both hot and cold. There was a white plate with delicate blue webbing, a 4 special plate, in front of each chair. The chairs were empty. The 4 special banquet plates were empty, and the wine glasses were empty, although the wine to fill them stood in golden buckets at intervals along the table, chilled and ready. It was as she had known it would be, as she had seen it in her fondest, clearest imaginings, as she had found it again and again and would find it as long as she and the chap needed it. Wherever she found herself, this castle was near. And if there was a smell of dampness and ancient mud, what of that? If there were scuttering sounds from the shadows under the table, mayhap the sound of rats or even Fortnoy weasels, why should she care? Above table, all was lush and lighted, fragrant and ripe and ready for taking. Let the shadows below table take care of themselves. That was none of her business. No, none of hers.
"Here comes Mia, daughter of none," she called gaily to the silent room with its 100 aromas of meats and sauces and creams and fruits. "I am hungry and I will be fed. Moreover, I'll feed my chap. If anyone would say against me, let him step forward. Let me see him very well, and he me."
No one stepped forward, of course. Those who might once have banqueted here were long gone. Now there was only the deep and sleepy beat of the slow trans engines, and those faint and unpleasant scampering sounds from the land of Undertable. Behind her, the gunslinger stood quietly watching. Nor was it for the first time. He saw no castle, but he saw her. He saw her very well.
"Silence gives consent," she called.
She pressed her hand to her belly, which had begun to protrude outward, to curve. Then with a laugh she cried,
"Aye, so it does. Here comes Mia to the feast. May it serve both her and the chap who grows inside her. May it serve them very well."
And she did feast. But not in one place, and never from one of the plates. She hated the plates, the white and blue 4 specials. She didn't know why, and didn't care to know. What she cared about was the food. She walked along the table like a woman at the world's grandest buffet, taking things with her fingers and tossing them into her mouth, sometimes chewing meat hot and tender right off the bone before slinging the joints back onto their serving platters. A few times she missed these, and the chunks of meat would go rolling across the white linen tablecloth, leaving splotches of juice in nosebleed stains. One of these rolling roasts overturned a gravy boat. One smashed a crystal serving dish filled with cranberry jelly. A third rolled clean off the far side of the table, where Mia heard something drag it underneath. There was a brief squealing squabble, followed by a howl of pain as something sank its teeth into something else. Then, silence. It was brief, though, and soon broken by Mia's laughter, she wiped her greasy fingers on her bosom, doing it slowly, enjoying the way the stains of the mixed meats and juices spread on the expensive silk, enjoying the ripening curves of her breasts and the feel of her nipples under her fingertips, rough and hard and excited. She made her way slowly down the table, talking to herself in many voices, creating a kind of lunatic chit-chat.
"How they hanging, honey?" "Oh, they hanging just fine. Thank you so much for asking, Mia. Do you really believe that Oswald was working alone when he shot Kennedy?" "Never in a million years, darling. That was a CIA job the whole way. Them are those honky millionaires from the Alabama Steel Crescent. Bombingham, Alabama, honey? Ain't it the truth? Have you heard the new Joan Baez record? My God, yes. Doesn't she sing like an angel? I hear that she and Bob Dylan are going to get themselves married."
And on, chitter and chatter. Roland heard Odetta's cultured voice and Detta's rough but colorful profanity. He heard Susanna's voice and many others as well. How many women in her head, how many personalities formed and half-formed. He watched her reach over the empty plates that weren't there and empty glasses, also not there, eating directly from the serving platters, chewing everything with the same hungry relish, her face gradually picking up the shine of grease, the bodice of her gown, which he did not see but sensed, darkening as she wiped her fingers there again and again, squeezing the cloth, matting it against her breasts. These motions were too clear to mistake. And at each stop, before moving on, she would seize the empty air in front of her and throw a plate he could not see either on the floor at her feet or across the table at a wall that must exist in her dream. "There," she'd scream in the defiant voice of Detta Walker, "there, you nasty old blue lady, I done broke it again, I broke your fucking plate, and how do you like it? How do you like it now?" Then, stepping to the next place, she might utter a pleasant but restrained little trill of laughter and ask so-and-so how their boy so-and-so was coming along down there at Moore House, and wasn't it wonderful to have such a fine school for people of color, just the most wonderful thing, and how is your mama, dear? Oh, I am so sorry to hear it. We'll all be praying for her recovery. Reaching across another of those make-believe plates as she spoke, grabbing up a great tureen filled with glistening black roe and lemon rinds, lowering her face into it like a hog dropping its face into the trough. Gobbling. Raising her face again, smiling delicately and demurely in the glow of the electric torches, the fish eggs standing out like black sweat on her brown skin, dotting her cheeks and her brow, nestling around her nostrils like clots of old blood. "Oh, yes, I think we are making wonderful progress. Folks like that Bull Connor are living in the sunset years now, and the best revenge on them is that they know it." And then she would throw the tureen backward over her head like a crazed volleyball player, some of the roe raining down in her hair. Roland could almost see it. And when the tureen smashed against the stone, her polite "isn't this a wonderful party" face would cramp into a ghoulish Detta Walker snarl, and she might scream, "There, you nasty old blue lady, how'd I feel? You want to stick some of that caviar up your dry-ass cunt, you go on and do it. You go right on. That'd be fine show." And then she would move on to the next place, and the next, feeding herself in the great banquet hall, feeding herself and feeding her chap, never turning to see Roland at all, never realizing that this place did not, strictly speaking, even exist. 4. Eddie and Jake had been far from Roland's mind and concerns as the four of them, five if Oi was counted, bedded down after feasting on the fried muffin balls. He had been focused on Susanna. The gunslinger was quite sure she would go wandering again tonight, and again he would follow after her when she did. Not to see what she was up to. He knew what it would be in advance. No, his chief purpose had been protection. Early that afternoon, around the time Jake had returned with his armload of food, Susanna had begun to show signs Roland knew. Speech that was clipped and short, movements that were a little too jerky to be graceful, an absent tendency to rub at her temple or above her left eyebrow as if there was a pain there. Did Eddie not see those signs? Roland wondered. Eddie had been a dull observer indeed when Roland first met him, but he had changed greatly since then, and he loved her. Loved her. How could he, and not see what Roland saw? The signs weren't quite as obvious as they had been on the beach at the edge of the Western Sea, when Detta was preparing to leap forward and wrest control from Odetta, but they were there all right, and not so different at that. On the other hand, Roland's mother had had a saying, "Love stumbles." It could be that Eddie was simply too close to her to see. Or doesn't want to, Roland thought. Doesn't want to face the idea that we might have to go through that whole business again. The business of making her face herself and her divided nature. Except this time it wasn't about her. Roland had suspected this for a long time, since before their palaver with the people of River Crossing, in fact, and now he knew. No, it wasn't about her. And so he'd lain there, listening to their breathing lengthen as they dropped off one by one. Oi, then Jake, then Susanna. Eddie last. Well, not quite last. Faintly, very faintly, Roland could hear a murmur of conversation from the folk on the other side of yonder south hill, the ones who were trailing them and watching them. Nerving themselves to step forward and make themselves known, very likely. Roland's ears were sharp, but not quite sharp enough to pick out what they were saying. There were perhaps half a dozen murmured exchanges before someone uttered a loud, shushing hiss. Then there was silence, except for the low, intermittent snuffling of the wind in the treetops. Roland lay still, looking up into the darkness where no stars shone, waiting for Susanna to rise. Eventually she did. But before that, Jake, Eddie, and Oi went toe-dash. 5. Roland and his mates had learned about toe-dash, what there was to learn, from Vanney, the tutor of court in the long ago when they had been young. They had been a quintet to begin with, Roland, Alain, Cuthbert, Jamie, and Wallace, Vanney's son. Wallace, fiercely intelligent but ever sickly, had died of the falling sickness, sometimes called King's Evil. Then they had been four and under the umbrella of True Quartet. Vanney had known it as well, and that knowing was surely part of his sorrow. Court taught them to navigate by the sun and stars. Vanney showed them compass and quadrant and sextant and taught them the mathematics necessary to use them. Court taught them to fight. With history, logic problems, and tutorials on what he called the universal truths, Vanney taught them how they could sometimes avoid having to do so. Court taught them to kill if they had to. Vanney, with his limp and his sweet but distracted smile, taught them that violence worsened problems far more often than it solved them. He called it the hollow chamber where all true sounds became distorted by echoes. He taught them physics, what physics there was. He taught them chemistry, what chemistry was left. He taught them to finish such sentences as, "That tree is like a..." and "When I'm running, I feel as happy as a..." and "We couldn't help laughing because..." Roland hated these exercises, but Vanney wouldn't let him slip away from them. "Your imagination is a poor thing, Roland," the tutor told him once. Roland might have been 11 at the time. "I will not let you feed it short rations and make it poorer still." He had taught them the 7 dials of magic.